Faculty Futures Lab is a faculty-led effort to consider the challenges facing institutions of higher education in complex and uncertain times. All guests speak from their own expertise and experience. Produced by the San Diego State University Center for Teaching and Learning. Learn more at ctl.sdsu.edu.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Faculty Futures Lab. I'm DJ Hopkins. I'm a professor at San Diego State University. This podcast is being recorded in the podcasting studio of SDSU's Digital Humanities Center, and special thanks to everybody who works there, Dr. Pam Lack, director of the Digital Humanities Center, and Patrick Flanagan, who is our technical guru who really makes us all sound great. Thanks, Pam. Thanks, Patrick. Let's get started. This is the first episode of Season 5 of Faculty Futures Lab. The first time I appeared as a guest on Faculty Futures Lab, I was Zooming from my garage during the pandemic on the thinnest of Wi-Fi signals with a headset microphone so bad it was held together with tape. But I also really enjoyed recording the podcast. I enjoyed the conversation. I enjoyed being in dialogue with my colleagues, so I kept coming back and eventually started figuring out how to host a podcast myself, which is obviously still a work in progress. Season 4 of Faculty Futures Lab was all about the impacts of generative AI on higher ed. You can check out all 5 episodes of Season 4 right now. This season will be different. We're back to more eclectic programming, and in fact, I am promising right now that I won't even mention generative AI for at least 2 episodes. I'll bet you $5. We'll see if it works. Season 5 is following a new theme, moving theory into practice. It's one of my favorite things to talk about when I talk about higher ed. The phrase ivory tower is an insult to some, but not to me. I could stay in my ivory tower and read lofty, conceptual stuff bristling with footnotes all day long. But also, I'm surrounded by artists, practitioners, professionals whose work takes them in and out of the ivory tower. Archaeologists and designers and healthcare professionals and psychologists. I could go on and on. These days, it seems that every discipline, no matter how arcane, is looking for ways to connect with the quote-unquote real world, an expression I actually hate. Universities exist in the real world, make real-world economic and intellectual impacts, and always have. But in this season of Faculty Futures Lab, we're going to be talking about the people whose professional activity is explicitly about blurring that already permeable boundary between theory and practice. And where better to begin than with a colleague who is also an award-winning teacher? Dr. Thais Alves is the AGC, Paul S. Roll Chair in Construction Engineering and Management in the Department of Civil, Construction, and Environmental Engineering at San Diego State University. Welcome, Thais.
Hello. Thank you, DJ. It's great to be here with you on the Faculty Futures Lab podcast.
And because Thais' title is so long, we really only have time just to say her title. If you want to get her full bio, check out the show notes where we'll have a link. But Thais, we're so glad you're here because you seem to love teaching, and that's really where I want to start. I've now seen you teach. At least I saw you briefly giving a snapshot of your history of construction class to some semi-willing student volunteers. But you and I are always running into each other and talking about teaching. So I've come to this conclusion. Am I right? Do you love teaching?
I do. I get so much out of teaching and the energy of working with our students here at San Diego State and being able to impact their lives. I just love this opportunity to be there for them.
Do you have a favorite subject? Because when you were talking about that 100-level history of construction class, you seemed energized.
Yes, I teach a 100-level class, which is also a general education course here at San Diego State, and it's called Construction and Culture. And during the semester, we go over different aspects of construction throughout time. So we evaluate different projects. We discuss how culture and social and political aspects might have influenced projects. And I'm always trying to make a connection between what happened in the past and what we see today in construction.
I love that so much. Also, when I run into you and we talk, you have on more than one occasion waxed poetic about our university's Center for Teaching and Learning. In fact, I gave you a T-shirt today from the Center for Teaching and Learning, and you held it up, and you were really pleased to have the T-shirt. You're like a CTL super fan, which, of course, I love. But one time when we were talking about the CTL, you said that the most valuable thing our CTL does was not any one particular program, but that it built community, a community of faculty on our campus. Why is that important to you?
Well, first of all, I'm a people's person. I really like community. I like to get engaged. I like to be around people. I eat my lunch outside of my office in front of the bookstore just so that I can be around people, right? Get some fresh air, some sunlight. But I also love that. And the fact that CTL promotes a community of teachers and scholars here on campus, I think this is fabulous. And I just wish everybody would take advantage of that.
I do want to get back to engineering, but also I'm going to stay with this for a second. I tend to think of university faculty as independent contractors. Each of us could, in theory, just go about our business, teach our classes, go do our professional activity, and really have nothing to do with anyone else other than passing in the hallway. And we all know faculty who actually do that most of the time. So is there a problem with that? Or to flip that script, what's the benefit of the we're all in this together culture you're describing?
Well, what I see is the more I talk to other people about how we teach, how we handle issues, how we organize assignments on Canvas, I have learned so much just going to the CTL lunches and seeing colleagues present what they are doing. I have to say that I haven't been to these meetings as of recently, but I would say my first 5 to 10 years here at SDSU, this is my, I just completed 15 years here, going to 16 right now. And I have learned so many different examples from conversations with people who were in CTL book clubs or CTL presentations. Right. There's so much to learn from that. We have to learn how to teach, and we never stop learning because the technology changes, the student body changes, all the issues that we face on a daily basis, like we have to adapt in so many different ways. We cannot just keep going the same way that I was doing things like 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm. We do have to learn to teach. I know when I was in grad school, it was very clear to me that I had to learn all of the subjects related to my discipline and that must be my focus. And yet at the same time I was teaching, but the assumption was just go teach and you'll figure it out as you go. It's intuitive. We all need to learn how to teach. And being part of a community that is collaborating and to be part of a community that's working together to continually improve our pedagogy is one of the exciting things about being at a university, one of the exciting things about being co-director of a Center for Teaching and Learning, to be able to host events that try to bring people together to do exactly that. I love that you love your CTL T-shirt.
Absolutely. I'm very thankful. And I think when I came here to San Diego State, in the very beginning, as I was attending these meetings, somebody told me that not just the teaching part, but how I should communicate about my research and my interests. So I was learning how to be a teacher scholar at San Diego State and how things are done here and how we interact with one another and so on. And I think I wouldn't have learned about that if it was not because of the CTL meetings.
Well, I learned from you that community is ultimately the most important thing. Because I get so in the weeds of programming this or setting up a theme for that or all the paperwork necessary just to buy some cookies and serve them to my colleagues while we're talking about the latest reading circle subject. I get so in the weeds that I forget the bigger picture. And when you said to me that building a community of faculty is something that you really valued that the CTL does, it was such a moment of clarity for me and helped me focus my big picture thinking about what our Center for Teaching and Learning really does. Thanks for that.
Yes, and I also, I want to tell you that I met people through the CTL who helped me with other issues on campus. Because as a new faculty, you don't know everything there is about this campus, right? Yeah. And some people who have been here for a longer time, they do. So as time passed, I became that resource. But when I came here, I had to rely on people that I would meet in these events.
I can't tell you how many times I've met someone who starts talking about a friend who's in a department on the other side of campus. And I'll say, how did you meet so-and-so? Oh, we were in the same cohort. We met at New Faculty Orientation. And now that I'm running New Faculty Orientation as co-director of CTL, I can already see these interdisciplinary relationships forming just from people who sat down at the same table on their first day on campus and started talking to the person sitting next to them. And then they come to our programming throughout the semester, and hopefully, there's this enhanced experience of belongingness that, you know, from the perspective of the numbers crunchers and the administration on campus, hopefully that will improve retention. But from the perspective of faculty, hopefully it improves well-being and a sense that, like, oh, I actually like this damn job.
And I'll tell you, I get so, like, I spent a lot of energy teaching, but I also get so much out of it that when we enter the summer, I feel this summer slump because the students are not around. I'm not teaching. I'm like, I miss that experience. I miss that energy. So I think it's a symbiotic relationship. I spend a lot of my energy teaching and trying to make my classes to be formative and also a good experience, but I also get so much out of it.
It's really great to talk to somebody who loves teaching and is so articulate about what she loves. Thank you.
You know, I'm a digital humanist, and we talk a lot about people as infrastructure. And what I'm hearing, you know, we talk a lot about, like, we're less concerned about a particular technology. It's about community, cross-disciplinary conversation. And it occurs to me, listening to the two of you talk about your relationship to teaching and your relationship to the Center for Teaching and Learning, that so much of what we're doing here, that you're doing, DJ, in your programming, but also what we're doing on the podcast, is to build the infrastructure for scholar teachers, to build those connections. And, you know, here's the little segue, right? Infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So thinking of infrastructure in all these different contexts, as people, as communities of practice, as disciplines, and disciplinary practice and things like that. So I'm not quite sure where to go with that thought, but it just kept sort of hitting me in the face.
I love that your perspective is to see all the ways in which these things are connected, that we are a network, really, which is another way of describing a community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thais, I want to talk about how you came to engineering. What was your path to that field?
Well, both my parents are medical doctors, and I discovered very quickly that I didn't want anything to do with that. Very quickly.
Okay. How quickly?
I was a little kid, and I was like, no, that's not what I'm doing. And then I had two uncles and one aunt who were civil engineers. Mm-hmm. And I was so fascinated by what they were doing, how their lives were, and what kind of activities they were involved in and projects that they had going on. And that was just like, I want to be like them. This sounds more like a profession I want to, you know, jump into.
Yeah.
And this was the start in engineering, right? But then as I moved along, I also got this love for research. Uh-huh. So the next thing I know, I went to my master's back in Brazil, in the south of Brazil at the Federal University of Rio Grande do Sul. Then I went to my PhD at UC Berkeley, and my college degree came from my hometown back in Brazil, Natal, from the Federal University of Rio Grande do Norte. So it's like very long names. But after I finished all that, I was like, okay, I can go and work in the industry, or I can do research that is applied, because the whole time that I was in my grad school, I was doing applied research. I did not have a lab on campus that I would go to. I was always talking to different companies, going to construction sites and seeing things as they were happening. So I don't have a lab to this day. My lab are the projects out there, the organizations out there.
Right.
And then I had the opportunity to teach, and I never looked back. And I continue to work with companies. I continue to rely on them for my research and for my teaching.
Yeah.
But I became an academic.
I don't want to skip over that moment. You had the opportunity to teach and you never looked back. You've already said that you love teaching, but what was the moment where you had the opportunity to teach?
I was invited to be a visiting scholar in a university back in Brazil, Federal University of Ceará. So there's this federal system back in Brazil, which is the cream of the crop. Mm. And when I went there, I was working with construction companies and also teaching. And then from there, I just went from one appointment to another. And then when the opportunity appeared for me to come to SDSU, I did come here.
I think it was my co-director, Allison Vaughn, who said she used to come into your classroom because she taught in the same room you did after you, and you were always preparing your students to go from the classroom to an actual site, including helping them get construction helmets fitted.
I just remembered I have a hard hat in my office that I should have busted out for this recording session.
That's good, because anything could happen here in the Digital Humanities Center if we learned anything over the summer.
Yeah. So I always bring guest speakers to my class, and sometimes, mm-hmm. She would be there, right. and she would see these people, with their boots, dirty boots, or with their jackets and, the vests.
Because they've just come in from the laboratory.
Exactly, here on campus, yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you take students to construction sites.
There was a point in time that I had a class that they were back-to-back classes. So she would arrive in class, and I would be leaving with a group of people to visit a site. Yeah. We don't do that very often, and we haven't done it recently because we don't have projects on campus right now.
Yeah.
But she did see that. She did see, the students putting the hats and the vests, but it was not. We have a class that does that every Friday. Mm-hmm. My class would do that, once a semester. Right, and then we would have other people who would come and speak, and they were in their construction gear. So I just want to be precise.
No, I appreciate precision.
Yeah,
that's probably important in your field.
Yeah,
in my field, not so much.
Yeah,
Thais, I know that the ratio of men to women in the engineering field is skewed. I know that on our campus, the ratio of male faculty, female faculty is skewed. What was it like then and how is it different now?
Okay.
Whatever then means to you.
Yeah. So then it's 2009 when I started here at SDSU. When I joined the College of Engineering, the college was smaller. We grew a lot over the past few years. But there was only three other female faculty. And then 2 years after I was here, one of them left. So we were three for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
So I was the only female faculty in my department. There was another one in electrical engineering, another one in mechanical engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while, that was it. Then, coincidentally, I went on maternity leave back in 2014. Mm-hmm. And when I came back, to my amazing surprise, there were two new female faculty in my department. So we went from three to five, just like that.
And from one to three in your own civil engineering
exactly.
program.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly. And it makes a difference because the students, I have had so many students, right, who come to me and say, I just want to let you know that I appreciate having a female faculty in engineering and seeing somebody with your level of responsibility and your connections and what you do, it's very inspiring. So I have had so many students say that. I advise two construction chapters. One is the AGC and CMAA. The other one is the Women in Construction.
Mm-hmm.
And just seeing the level of community that they created and the environment that they are developing for everybody, not just in construction, but also in engineering, because the meetings are open. I mean, right now we also have a program in the College of Engineering that is called Women in Engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And the program brings together all the female faculty, and now we are, I think, 16 or 17 maybe. So it's a manifold change, right? And we have the students who also come to the WE meetings, and we want to create this community. It's open to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at, for example, construction engineering, which is my field, construction engineering management, construction engineering has about 10-15% female participation.
Mm-hmm.
And construction management maybe has 15 to 20-25%.
Mm.
We have a lot of work to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we see the difference. I see the difference right now. We have a lot more female participation, but we have a long ways to go. Yeah. The only engineering major that we have here that is balanced, gender balanced, is environmental engineering, which is 50-50. Hmm. But the other ones are all skewed towards having more men.
What is it like when you go to a construction site? What is it like when you take students to a construction site? What do they see? And how are you and they treated?
So first of all, I would like to name drop here. I have a colleague who does that, who does a phenomenal job taking our students to construction sites. Her name is Nancy LaCrory. She is a fabulous instructor, a fabulous person, and I just want to recognize her for that. She takes our students to many field trips. So my class per se is not a field trip class. Nancy's class is. But when I do take them, I used to take them here on campus, it's fabulous to see when they get to the construction site and they see the action, because you see the building in bare bones. So we got to see, for example, the new theater that we have at SDSU. We saw when everything was there and nobody could imagine what was happening behind those walls, and our students could actually see. Like, they saw the Snapdragon Stadium being built because my colleague, my friend Nancy, took them there, right? That's so awesome. They get to see these projects, or the San Diego Symphony Hall. Nobody sees those things, but our students do, and they see how complex construction is, how much you need the technology, how much you need equipment, but most importantly, how much you need people, right? So they have to understand that the industry moves because we have a lot of people behind it, and there is a lot of coordination that goes on. So they see all that, and we are extremely lucky here in San Diego because we are in a metropolitan area, so we have access to these construction sites that maybe other CSUs, other universities don't have. We are blessed beyond belief here.
I want to come back to women in engineering, but I think one of the most exciting construction projects that's happened in San Diego that's really made me feel good about San Diego is we built a multi-billion dollar trolley extension as part of our metropolitan transit system. I think it's pretty great to live in a city that's spending that kind of money to expand public transportation.
Yes, and the amazing part of this, we get to bring guest speakers to class that talk about this project. So for the my course, the construction and culture course, the 100 level CONI 101, the folks who build the trolley, they came and talked to the students. So that's another point of my teaching that I love, is to be able to rely on the local industry to bring their experience to the classroom, to show the students what kind of activities they develop, how their day looks like, the challenges that they face constructing these projects. But we get to collaborate with these folks, and they are extremely supportive. I'm so thankful for having that around our program.
I'm just going to center my own identity here. I'm a straight, white, middle-aged man. I have not encountered the sexism I'm asking about here. But I've witnessed it. I've known plenty of women who have confronted it. And I can remember when, even in my field, people were openly asking questions like, do you really think a woman could be an artistic director of this theater company? Within my lifetime, within just a handful of decades, which seemed even then an utterly absurd question to be asking. But even today, there are a lot of Americans wondering whether or not a woman could actually be president, could actually be commander-in-chief. So I'm asking these questions about the field that your growing number of women students are going to be entering, and, you know, just exactly what it's like on the work sites, what the working conditions are. But it sounds like you're seeing the numbers go up because the community that's making these work sites actually function has become more welcoming.
Yes.
Is that fair to say?
Yes, and there are groups nowadays that different companies, they have groups that they create this support group, I would say, for lack of a better word. They are recruiting more women. They have a lot of women in positions of leadership in very, very male-dominated areas within construction. I think now we have women in all of them. So the more you see, seeing is believing. They see somebody who is a superintendent, which is a very tough job in a construction site, deals with the workers, close to the workers, with the foremen and the workers, but also deals with the project management side.
Right.
And they see somebody like that and they think, I can do that too. And we have had students who went just that path. So seeing is believing, right? The more we see and the more they bring people here on campus to talk about these issues. And they are so busy that right now, if our company asks them for this fall semester, if they have space to come and talk to them, their schedule is packed. It's totally full. So that tells you how much the companies want to come here, interact with the students, interact with the Women in Construction chapter, and also the other chapters that we have. My point is, there is an effort to change things, right? We are, I think we are in a better trajectory. The students see that, and they want to be part of it.
If you could predict where you will be and where your field will be in like 5 to 10 years, what do you imagine?
So what's next? For me, the next frontier, which we are already crossing right now, we need buildings that are more sustainable, more resilient, more socially adaptive, if you will. And we will have technologies coming in, going out, becoming obsolete, learning new ones. There is the entire AI discussion right now. But at the end of the day, as I said, construction is a people type of industry. We need people to build. We need people to manage. And it doesn't matter how much technology you have. You always have to have people behind it. And on top of that, we have been working on discussions in class. If you, like, I think engineering students, they have this, they are stereotypically labeled disengaged, right? The engineers, they want to engineer, they want to do calculations, or the construction managers want to manage, and they are not socially engaged. And I think many of us are working on topics in class that bring social justice issues to the classroom. If you are building, if you are designing, if you are maintaining a facility, you have to understand the impact that all that has on your community, right? And on top of that, you have to remember that these buildings, they have to meet code, they have to stay standing after an earthquake, they have to promote a healthy environment. And there are so many things that we are bringing to classroom that maybe they were not there 15, 20 years ago. But moving forward, we just see more and more of that.
Oh, that's inspiring.
Yeah, I have so many snaps for that. That was so awesome.
Thais, thanks so much for being on Faculty Futures Lab.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
If you're enjoying this episode, stick around for these outtakes. That's just so perfect that you mentioned that, because you were talking about that with Erlinda at the photo shoot a couple of weeks ago. Erlinda, who's going to be our next
guest. Next week,
talks about sustainability, and the two of them were like, oh, we should teach a class together.
Oh, that would be so
sustainability rad. And construction.
Yeah. I just love how everything kept coming back to people. Right? Like, it's about the people, and you just said that over and over in this amazingly beautiful way, and even pushing on the sort of stereotype of the engineer and, like, the social aspects of engineering and the
socially responsive construction?
Yeah.
Love it.
It was just like, ooh, it's like my kind of talk.
And I think I'm the humanist sort of. I for example, in my department, we have environmental engineering, and the environmental engineering professors, they are more attuned to social issues because they work with environmental issues and all that. The other ones are like, we want to design. The other ones are like, we want to build, right? The civil engineers want to design. The construction engineers, construction managers, they want to build. But at the end of the day, we have to bring this discussion to class. We cannot just, they cannot just be doing these calculations without knowing how that impacts the rest of the society. Right?
So I know, even though this isn't really part of the episode, but you know, we were talking about like sex and gender discrimination in engineering, and I'm wondering if there's like a hierarchy of disciplines in engineering, as you might see in some other field, right? And are you seeing like more women coming to your discipline because it's socially responsive engineering? Is that getting devalued because it's being feminized? Are you seeing anything like that?
That's a great question. So I said that the most balanced major out of the ones we have here is environmental engineering, mm-hmm. which is 50-50. Mm-hmm. And we had this discussion many times, and it might be because environmental engineering is perceived as more socially responsible, and there is research that points to female engineers wanting to be more attuned and more responsible to what's happening in their environment, right? And they might not see themselves doing the same good if they become construction engineers or construction managers, even though they will. I had a guest speaker today in my class who said, you should be so proud of the field that you chose because you are going to make people's lives better. Mm. So the students, I tell them, you change everything that is around us. When you wake up in the morning, you have water on the tap. You have a shower. You have a sewage system that works. You have a road, the sidewalks. Who put these things in there, right? So mm-hmm. we make people's lives better with construction. And that just tells me that we have to be more socially responsible. I think that I cannot speak for the other engineering fields, but in general, I think all of us, we are more concerned about that. Some more than others, mm-hmm. right? Depending on how much you interact, like you front face people. Mm-hmm. But I think everybody's concerned about that one way or another. And our accreditor has put accreditation guidelines related to that too. Nice. So that mm-hmm. is an extra push for people to actually pay more attention and document the attention that you are paying to it.
Mm.
Thais, do you walk around San Diego looking at construction sites and just or like road work construction and just going, like, oh, no, oh, boy.
Totally.
Or do you sometimes? Yeah, I was going to flip the script, but I didn't need to.
Oh, my goodness. I drive around, and sometimes if I can, I enter a parking lot to take a picture. And my daughter's like, no, mom, no, you are not going to stop to take a picture. And it's not that I take a picture when I'm driving. I stop at a parking lot. Uh-huh, I park sure. the car. I get out of the car and I start taking pictures. And everywhere I go, I think a few weeks ago we were somewhere and she was like, look, mom is so cute taking pictures of these construction sites because everywhere I go, mm-hmm. I see these things. I see engineering. Yep. I want to document that. Mm-hmm. It's so cool.
I also That's just great. Wanted to note, so I went to graduate school in North Carolina, and you know, they've been hit very hard by a hurricane, and Western North Carolina is just like decimated. And when you were talking about engineering and construction as socially responsible and doing good, thinking about the importance of the work that you do and what you're teaching in terms of like life or death, like we need this kind of sustainable, responsive infrastructure to survive climate change and the climate crisis. And so like you're doing that.
Yes, I failed to mention climate change, but that's exactly what's happening right now, right? We see in front of us, and we were just having a discussion in class about that because some of the data we have to design buildings. So to design buildings and infrastructure, you need reliable data that was collected in the past so that you can use to make predictions and design new structures. Well, the data that we have right now is totally outdated because of the prevalence of climate-related events that are changing how our infrastructure handles, for example, rain, how much rain, how often, right? So we need to pay attention to that too because it's a big change and everybody has to pay attention to that during all phases of construction. When people are pulling the data to design, when the builders are building the building, when the owner is operating the building, during this entire time, we have to have in mind these changes because they are right in front of us. I tell my students, this is a crisis, but this is also an opportunity because it means that this infrastructure, the buildings, they are going to have to be fixed to adapt to this new reality, right? And on top of this, we have earthquakes here, which we don't predict. But for example, hospitals, they have to be built to withstand a 7.0 earthquake.
Wow.
It's a lot of work to make a hospital that foolproof, right? That resilient.
Thais, thank you so much. I think we're going to add this extended portion of the interview at the end of the podcast because it's just been great talking to you.
Thank you. It was great. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.